I struggle with the way I look. It's complicated. I remember looking in the mirror, not understanding why people were laughing at me, because I thought I looked good. I thought I looked okay. But because people were laughing at me, I couldn't work it out. And I think that kind of preoccupation, this negative preoccupation that I've experienced quite a lot, has really, in a way, made it very hard for me to really see myself. The first time I realised that I was black was when I was watching television, and there was this black woman on the television, and I remember laughing at her and making fun of her. And an older girl who was also black like me came to me and said, "And who do you think you are?" That was the first time I realised that I was like the woman on the television. I didn't understand fully what that meant, really. I just knew that the woman on the television and myself and Geraldine, the older girl, we were the same, and it didn't feel good. I remember many experiences when I was a child of having adults make fun of me, or children make fun of me, calling me nigger, gollywog, black tar baby. And it has happened in every town that I've gone into in Ireland. I've experienced this type of name calling. So it's actually something that I've learned, that I've lived with all of my life, this type of attention, negative attention. The kind of names that I was called were the same kind of names that were used to insult people who looked like me, and only people who looked like me. So I knew that certain words were to do with the colour of my skin. If you were insulted because of the way you look, if your differences, and I was reminded in many ways that I was different, but that my difference was unacceptable, and that meant that people laughed at you and made fun of you, of course you're going to start feeling that you look ugly. You want to hide. You don't want to be seen outside in case somebody else made fun of you. So as a child, I used to look in the mirror and wonder why. I couldn't understand why they were laughing at me, because I knew I looked okay. I always knew I looked okay. But some part of me felt that I must be ugly, though I felt I looked okay. I must be ugly if people are making fun of you. And people who, it weren't just children, it was adults, it was men, it was women. But it wasn't that they just made fun of you. They also looked at you with such a hostile look. The kind of looks that I experienced as a child were looks of hatred as well. So it wasn't just people mocking you. Adults were actually looking at you with such hostility that it can only be described as hate. And I would just close in and withdraw and hide. I wouldn't go outside and play. It just felt unsafe. I felt that that being black, being brown, meant that I wasn't like white children. And I felt that because of the way I was treated. It's not that I felt excluded, I just didn't feel wanted. It wasn't so much that I didn't feel I was Irish, I just felt that I was different. I felt that I didn't want to be this different, because being this different meant experiencing incredible pain quite a lot of the time. That's what I was with. To be Irish, that meant nothing to me in a sense. I didn't understand that. You know, I didn't feel Irish, but I didn't know what that meant. I just knew that I was different because people kept reminding me that I was different. Go for it?
Yes.
I went to Clifton when I was 11 months old. I was sent there by the courts, I think, in Dublin. My mother, I'm told by the document that I have, and on the document it says that my mother financially couldn't support me or my sister Carol. And my grandfather kicked both my mother and myself and Carol out of his house, so she had nowhere to look after us. So she kept Carol and she sent me to Clifton. I was there for 15 years. There were about 75 of us there in the school. It was called St. Joseph's School. It was an industrial school, and it was there for to give us some type of training to prepare us for the outer world. The last time I came up here was, I'd say, a couple of years ago. This is a kind of a little hut type stone. There's a hole, and I used to pretend that was my home. It's just, you can only fit about two people in there. And I remember sticking my head up one day and being caught by the head nun. She just saw me, and I thought I knew I was doomed. That was quite frightening. But I loved that little hidey place. It was a place where you could hide and not be seen. That's the laundry, where I used to go and do the laundry. The nuns as well. There was a woman called Mary Early. She lived here all her life, from the time that she was a child till she was, I think, 85. And she worked all of those years doing the laundry for the nuns. Sewing and ironing, the whole lot. She worked so hard. That's my bedroom up there. That's the dormitory that I would have been in that dormitory first, that first one, when I was young, and then I was moved into this one when you got older. That's my window bedroom up there. Oh, it's cold.
The light's on in there.
Okay, well, let's not.
see what happens. You never know.
Does this make you nervous?
That makes me nervous over there, looking at the convent, because I'm always aware that they could be looking out, watching, you know. It's not... This area here wouldn't have been the most comfortable area to be in, because you could always be spotted. And it's just... Let me try...
Can I get in? Can I get in? Over here. So there might be somebody in charge here.
Hello.
How you doing? Gotcha. My name is Sharon Murphy. Is there somebody that I can speak with?
I'm from RTE.
Oh, yeah,
and I was wondering, Sharon grew up here, and I was hoping she could just show me around. Would that be possible, do you know?
Yeah, well, I'm here, so...
Thanks very much.
Called out.
It was run by the Mercies, the Mercy Nuns. There were two nuns in charge, and then there were about six, maybe five or six staff, lay people from the community that would come up and look after us, like... cook food and help us along the way, I suppose. Clean the place.
And we'd have to study here for a few hours. This is also the dining room as well, the dining room area where we used to eat, yeah? Well, I have to say it's a bit not very nice being in the building. It's not a nice feeling at all.
Do you want to leave?
No, I'm just... Hello, how you doing? Can I just come in here?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. This is the press where they had suites. They'd have those suites locked in. And there'd be times when they might leave... the lock off by mistake, and I used to do the butter. My job was to bring in the butter and roll it and put it back into the fridge, so if anybody would notice, it would be me, and I'd never say anything, and they'd have bags of boxes of crisps there, and I would take as many as I could. I'd put them into my knicker so that they wouldn't be seen, yeah, okay, and then I'd have to walk very slowly, because just down there, two doors down, would be the nun's office, and if she even heard me, my fear was that she'd say, "What are you doing?" And therefore she'd hear the crisps rattle. Yeah. So I used to, once I passed the office, then I was, as far as I was concerned, I was free home. I ran upstairs and I just piled them into me. It was a nice feeling. This is where the cooking took place.
When I was very young, we were quite hungry. There was very, very little food. I'm told since that there was money, but it was directed in other places, like maybe too much money was used for nappies or something. In any case, we were quite hungry. And then this nun was asked to leave, and another nun came along. We thought things would be better and food got better, but the beatings didn't actually stop. They continued.
You got bet for not being able to eat your food, not being able to spell, not being able to read. And you got tested quite a lot, so it was a regular thing. You got bet if you wet the bed. You got bet for anything that they disapproved of. Whether you were able to succeed in what it is that they wanted you to succeed in. It was really irrelevant. You just got bet if you didn't live up to their expectations. And the kind of beatings that we got would be, they had this hem brush, and it's a wooden stick, that's what it is. And they used to just belt us with this. They used to come down so heavy. You have to understand that these were adults. beating, like 6 and 7 year old children. Our hands had to stand out. We had to put our hands out, and if we tried to protect ourselves by bringing our hands back in, that meant that you got more beating. So you literally learned to stand as a child and just keep your hands out and just try and not cry, because you knew that if you cried, you got more beatings. And that may have been only because I couldn't have spelt the word colour, or I wasn't able to eat that day. That's why you got bet. I got bet for not knowing the mysteries of the rosary, the day that the mysteries fell on.
If I couldn't spell, the head nun would go into the office and bring out a hand brush, a wooden hand brush, and she'd give you 3 on each hand, and they were really, really bad. And you'd just roar out crying, you couldn't help it.
Well, there. What's the second verse? Oh, God.
I was just... See, these rooms had different lives, you know. There was times when this room would be used for babies. This was our bathroom here.
I don't know why, but I always I liked this room here. Maybe it was because you could see outside these windows and just see everything kind of around you. You know, you had a chance of maybe if somebody was coming in or something, you'd see them first before they saw you.
That was a. This room here is a child's. This was a room for babies. So I would have been put in here when I was 11 months old. This would have been the room I would have been kept in. And I have one memory where I'm sitting up on the pram, and there's this woman called Teresa, and she used to look after me, and she liked me. But I remember Teresa was... I could just remember Teresa fighting or with another woman. I don't know how old I was. And all of a sudden, this older woman came and clouted me across the face.
because that's what you do if you're, you know, you take it out on somebody. That if you're angry with somebody, the chances are you'll also hurt them if you hurt someone they like, you know. And I think that's, looking back, I think that's what, that's why she hit me.
The children watch now. I know what's going through their minds. Relief. They're all escaped. This turtle.
I had some friends in the orphanage, and we just did things together, you know. We played soccer, we ran around, and we just fought and played together. We were just friends.
I think it's kind of hard in one way. I think we were close in the sense that we felt that it was a them and us. But we didn't learn to be close because we didn't experience adults being close. We fought. We were friends. We had friends. Like, I had a couple of friends, close friends. There was no encouragement to have a family experience or have a family type of environment, really. That was up to us to make the best of the situation that we found ourselves in, you know.
When we got older, they partitioned off the, made them into kind of rooms, so that it was a dormitory when I was here, when I was a child. And then they just partitioned them off and turned them into bedrooms. And this one was mine. Do you know, not a lot has changed, really, has it? When you think of it, like, yeah.
When I was, when it was a dormitory, I was sleeping over on that side. And we used to, one of the nuns used to, as a joke, used to put on the alarm to wake us up in the morning. The fire alarm was our wake-up call. So it's kind of odd, really. I keep waiting for them to come in with their keys in their hands. It's just a feeling of dread. And I know I can look after myself, I'm an adult, but I still feel that sense of not really wanting to meet them, feeling really uncomfortable that they might walk in on us, you know. That's how I'm feeling. So I'm kind of looking forward to getting out of the building, you know. I was 6 when I went to Westport, and I'd go to Westport and spend holidays there, summer holidays and Christmas holidays, Easter holidays. And that was an amazing experience, in that it was so different to what I experienced in the orphanage. When I was in the foster family, I remember breaking a cup once. And I remember my foster mother just coming over to clean it up and said, "Don't hurt yourself." If I ever broke a cup in the orphanage, it meant that I got bet. So there were differences. And I remember watching my foster mother pick up the glass and realize and couldn't understand why she was okay about that. I expected that she would get very angry, and she didn't. She was concerned about me, and that was an amazing experience. It was Christmas, and I remember they talked about Santa Claus, and that made not a lot of sense to me. And I remember running down the stairs, and everybody, there was like 5 younger kids, and we all ran in, and there was this chair with my name on the chair, and there were sweets and books and jumpers and stuff all on the chair. And I looked around, and everybody else had chairs with goodies on their chairs. And And I was so amazed that all of this stuff was for me and that it was Santa Claus that gave it to me. But the most amazing thing was that Santa knew my name because my name was on the chair. And I was so amazed that the Santa Claus could know my name. The feelings were just, I had such an amazing experience, just having such abundance. I got a red jumper and I got jeans and I got socks and I got Bunty. I just remember everything. It was just amazing. I'd never had Santa before that time. That was my first experience of what Santa was about.
RTE came into this room and they filmed children that were in bed here. This is the room that they filmed in.
Is this your room?
I was, actually it's interesting because I was asked to leave the bed so somebody else could get into my bed so that RTE could film in here. And I was very envious because one of the kids got my bed. And then when it was all over, I had to go back into the bed again, which I thought was very unfair.
How old would you have been at the time?
About 7, maybe. 7. But it was lovely. It was really good fun having RTE here because they had cameras and it was just men in the house as well, which was unusual, you know, to have males. The only male I would have been somebody I would have known in Westport, so here it was kind of unusual.
And why do you think they wanted you out of your bed for this event?
I don't know. I think probably because, I don't know, I always thought maybe because the other child looked nicer than me. I didn't know why. That's what I assumed.
I felt that I didn't want to stay in the orphanage. I felt that no matter how hard I felt I was trying to be good, to be successful, it never stopped the beatings. Never. I didn't always know why I was getting bad. And if you weren't getting bad, you were witnessing beatings quite a lot. So I lived in an environment pretty much that was based around fear and control. And living in that experience, for me, I feel really has affected me till this day. I think what I felt was, I felt that I wanted to have a family, that I wanted to leave the orphanage. I wanted the beatings to stop, and I used to just fantasize all the time. I would fantasize that I was leaving and that other people would be coming, like my mother or people that I had fallen in love with over the years that would just come up and just take me away. I don't know if I felt lonely. I know that I felt unsafe and I didn't like where I was living quite a lot of the time. And I remember feeling that the safest place at times were going to bed, where I would just pull the covers over my head and just feel at least they won't touch me here in the bed. This was a place where you could sleep and you were expected to be in that bed. And therefore I used to feel that a little bit safer. Sometimes we had visitors come and stay in. They come and spend some time with us. And I'd go into a fantasy, them coming to take me out, you know, take me away. If that's lonely, that's all I know. If that's what lonely is. Sometimes mothers and fathers would come back and take their children back. And that I used to just envy that so much. I used to wish that my family would come back and take me out. And when you saw families coming back to take the kids back out, it just kind of made you feel, well, I felt that I wasn't loved, you know? I think that kind of reinforced that message, is that I wasn't really cared for. that mothers and fathers who came back for their children must really like them and take them home again because they cared. So why didn't mine? That, I suppose, yeah. I don't know if I understood what was happening to me. I just didn't like it.
It was so unnecessary, really, what they did.
Does it seem much smaller to you now than it did when you were small?
That's what I noticed. It's tiny. It's like... It felt so huge when we were little, you know, and it was too, you know, because when you're small.
Did you feel safe, Michelle?
Safe? No, I didn't feel safe here. I felt safe in my bedroom, in my bed, when I used to go to bed. I felt it was the one time that maybe they didn't pick on you, that they'd leave you alone, you know. So I used to love going to bed, actually. I used to put the clothes around me and... there's a door. I want to go.
Okay.
Okay. As a child, I was always seen as people would say, Anne Murphy sing. So I think people saw me as a singer in one way. And in another way, I was seen as copying somebody else because there was an older girl 2 years older than me and she was an amazing singer and a guitar player. I used to envy her. I used to watch her every move, every time. And she used to write songs at a very young age. And so I used to imitate her, and so therefore I was considered a copycat. I remember one time this priest from, he was coming over from the missionaries, coming back home to Clifton for a holiday, and he came to visit us, and he asked who would sing, and some people said, Anne Murphy will sing. So I started the song, and... just as I started the song, I realised that I had started on a very high note. And I knew by the middle of the song I wasn't going to make it. So I started to sing anyway, and it was really, really high. And I had to stop in the middle of the song, and I could feel the embarrassment and this. Oh, I just wanted to die. And I remember this priest looking at me he had dark brown eyes. And he looked at me and he says, oh, that is just so lovely. Thank you so much. And I just went mad in love with him. It was just so lovely just to get him look at me and talk to me. It was worth it. I was very shy. I didn't sing in public very much because I really wasn't all that encouraged in one way to sing. My voice developed at the age of 23, I think. I had joined a band, and there were two other female voices who were doing, they were doing harmony to what I was doing, and I remember just singing along with them, and one day my voice started to just really become very powerful. It was quite, I don't know, it was an amazing experience because I hadn't felt that I had that kind of power in my voice at all. I had up till then felt very restricted. I didn't feel confident. And then once my voice took off, I never turned back really. It was,
I feel that there's an amazing amount of power, volume in me. And I just felt that it just happened in its own way.
I understand why it's taken time. What was forbidden to feel remained hidden in me. Who was there to hold us? Who could we trust? It's by no coincidence we bear.
Abandonment. I don't know. I don't know. I didn't even know that I had any affection for my mother until I'd say 7 years ago. I wrote a song called Mama. I had actually originally planned to write the song about the orphanage and to just express what was going on. What happened to me, and that was my first time of really looking back and trying to make sense of what happened. And it was interesting because the song had its own direction and I went with it, and within 10 minutes I had a song written about my mother, and I just broke down and cried, I think, for hours. And that was the first time that I realized that I was deeply affected by the loss of not having a mother. I was sure that because I never had her, I didn't need her. But obviously there was some part of me who knew that I actually did still long for her. There's times when I feel actually quite cross with her, actually, because I don't know why she left me here in Ireland. I was born in England, and a few months after I was born she came to Ireland, and it just feels like she just left me here. I don't understand that, because as a black child, a black person, I would have probably had a better chance of creating some type of protection from racism if I had stayed in England, or if she left me in England or sent me away into some orphanage in England. So I'm angry around that she just left me here. And as a black child, I've had to deal with that, and that has been a lot. That has caused a lot of pain for me, unnecessary pain. Maybe I might have experienced as much pain in England. I don't know, but that's what I think. Sometimes I kind of go blank because I feel most of my life in Ireland there has been a sort of a denial around racism. And when I've tried to talk to people about the damage and what happens to me, there's this silence. Many times I'd get this silent experience. Reaction, I should say, and would make me feel that it was not a subject to talk about. So now, when I do talk about it, I'm also, I get very tense. I can get very tense and feel uncomfortable about it because I'm not used to talking about it freely, you know. I just feel that it's been so, in a way, it's so taboo in this country. It's been a topic that hasn't really got much attention. That when you grow up in an environment that where you're not allowed to really talk about what's happening to you, it becomes normal. Even that becomes normal. So you, I suppose, in a way, my survival was to stay silent. That was what you can call an ally, you know. One of my coping mechanisms was to keep quiet about it, because if I talked about it, I didn't want to see again and again people looking at me saying that I was maybe just looking for attention or that I had a chip on my shoulder. There were all of these sort of defences put up in front of me to deny me again and again and again what I was experiencing all the time. I suppose racism is, it's like experiencing unrelenting messages all the time telling you that you're different and that your difference is not accepted. It's living with that experience daily and living with that rejection daily. That is what racism is. I've been pushed and I've been spat on. I've been screamed at and shouted at to get out. People walking across the, on the other side of the road, some of them feel it's a-okay to scream at me and tell me to get out, you know, and to go back to where I belong. That happens quite a bit. I used to get money from priests on the street, and I'd sometimes go into confessions and I'd get money in there too. And I think it was because it was this kind of notion of the black baby thing, yeah, where priests just gave money to black babies. It didn't matter where you were.
I'm black with type of dreadlock hair, curly hair. Is that what you want?
Yes.
I've been asked to describe myself before.
Tell me how you look.
I have black eyes. I am dark skinned. My hair is quite long. It's like it's curly type dreadlock hair. And I suppose that's it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.